This is a Triple J podcast.
Hack. Hey, it's Dave Marchese. This is the Hack Podcast. We're all pretty used to forking out for card surcharges these days. Like, maybe you don't even notice it anymore when you go to pay for something and a little bit's added on because you're paying electronically. Why does it happen? And how much do these little amounts add up? Later, we're going to explain why Australian customers are slapped with these surcharges when they're banned in other countries and what you can do to avoid paying more. Also coming up, the toxic culture that's driving out Wikipedia moderators. What is going on? First, though.
Hack.
There must be an immediate ceasefire.
On Triple J.
Gaza is on the brink of famine. That's according to UN experts. There are reports of people eating leaves to stay alive, children dying from malnutrition. The US vice president is now calling for a ceasefire and for Israel to significantly boost the amount of aid that's being delivered to Palestinians. And furious talks are underway at the moment to try to sort out some kind of a deal. But is it going to happen? Well, in a bit, we'll speak to an expert on ceasefires to see how likely this is and when we could see a ceasefire. But first, here's Arianna Lucente with an update on the situation in Gaza at the moment.
It's been nearly 5 months of war in Gaza. The UN estimates 1.9 million people have been displaced and about a quarter of the territory's population is starving.
What is happening to us is unjust. It is unfair. We are people who just want to live and eat.
That's a man inside a hospital in Gaza City, where people are getting treated for injuries after a deadly incident late last week that local authorities say was an attack by Israel on Palestinians waiting for aid, and that Israel says was a stampede. The health ministry in Gaza says at least 110 civilians were killed during an aid truck delivery, claiming Israeli forces opened fire. Here's an eyewitness who spoke to Al Jazeera.
The Israelis just opened random fire on us, as if it was a trap. Once we approached the aid trucks, the Israeli tanks and warplanes started firing on us. If this continues like this, we do not want any aid delivered at all. Every convoy coming means another massacre.
But Israeli spokesman Daniel Haggari says soldiers didn't carry out a strike, just fired warning shots.
Our initial review has confirmed that no strike was carried out by the IDF towards the aid convoy. The majority of Palestinians were killed or injured as a result of the stampede.
The attacks have been condemned by the United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres, who said people were killed and injured while seeking life-saving aid. In a statement to Hack, the Foreign Minister Penny Wong said Australia was horrified by last week's catastrophe. US Vice President Kamala Harris has called it a tragedy.
We saw hungry, desperate people approach aid trucks, simply trying to secure food for their families after weeks of nearly no aid reaching northern Gaza. And they were met with gunfire and chaos.
The desperation is widespread. United Nations officials say Gaza is on the brink of famine.
With at least 576,000 people in Gaza, one step away from famine, with one in six children under 2 years of age in northern Gaza suffering from acute malnutrition and wasting. And practically the entire population of Gaza are left to rely on woefully inadequate humanitarian food assistance to survive.
Over the weekend, the United States airdropped 38,000 meals into Gaza, and videos show desperate people running to catch pallets being dropped on the territory by parachute. A former USAID mission director to the West Bank and Gaza says the deliveries won't make much of an impact.
38,000 ready-made meals dropped into southern Gaza equals about half of a truck. And we should be getting in 500 to 1,000 trucks every single day, given the humanitarian deficit that we have right here.
So why isn't more aid getting into Gaza? Well, to put it in context, about 500 trucks entered Gaza each day before the war. In February, around 98 trucks on average crossed into the Strip. But on several days last month, the number of trucks was in the single digits, according to the United Nations. Humanitarian officials say Israel, which controls security at border crossings into Gaza and which checks trucks entering into the Rafah crossing with Egypt, is deliberately obstructing the entry of aid. But Israel denies this. Instead, it blames the United Nations for failing to distribute it to those in need, or even diverting it to Hamas.
We're going to insist that Israel facilitate more trucks and more routes to get more and more people the help they need. No excuses, because the truth is, aid flowing to Gaza is nowhere nearly enough.
Health authorities in Gaza say more than 30,000 Palestinians have now been killed, and more than 70,000 people have been wounded since Israel launched its offensive. The invasion happened after the October 7 attack, when Hamas gunmen killed 1,200 people in southern Israel and took 250 people hostage. Israel says about 130 hostages are still in Gaza. So, where are we at with ceasefire talks? A Hamas delegation is in Cairo in Egypt right now to negotiate a ceasefire and a potential exchange of hostages for Palestinian prisoners. But Israeli officials aren't there, reportedly because they want to know which hostages are still alive and how many Palestinian prisoners Hamas wants in exchange. The US has been pushing for a ceasefire before the start of Islam's holy month Ramadan this weekend, and it's something polls suggest voters there want to see. Polling from Australian humanitarian groups suggests about 4 in 5 Aussies support a ceasefire too, and the majority want the Australian government to take more action. Australia has supported votes calling for a ceasefire at the UN. It has also paused funding to a key agency delivering aid to Gaza, UNRWA, after allegations that some staff members were involved in the October 7 attacks on Israel. Save the Children Australia's CEO, Matt Tinkler, says withholding funding is effectively removing the crumbs Gaza's children are surviving on. Penny Wong says Australia is providing more than $40 million in aid, and that additional support for Gaza will be announced in coming days. Palestinian journalist and Gaza resident Akram Es-Satari has this message for Australians.
I want the people in Australia to hear the outcries of the people who were killed and injured while they're trying to get some food for themselves and for their families. I'd like them to hear the sound of Gaza.
Hack on Triple J.
Ariana Lucente with that update. So what is going on with these ceasefire negotiations? Are they going to amount to anything? When could we see a ceasefire? Let's get into that with an expert. Marika Sosnowski is a research fellow at Melbourne Law School, an expert in ceasefires, and she's with us now. G'day, Marika. Thank you very much for coming on Hack.
Hi, Dave. Always great to be with you.
How likely do you think it is that a ceasefire is going to be reached for Gaza?
Look, I think it's quite likely. I hope it is likely anyway. I think both parties being Israel and Hamas, want a ceasefire for different reasons, obviously. I mean, Israel wants the hostages released and Hamas wants the bombardment of the Strip to stop. So I think that kind of makes it quite likely that one will be reached. When it will be reached is still an open question, I guess.
And obviously the negotiations have been underway furiously for some time now. I imagine a lot goes into these negotiations and talks. What's the most difficult part of reaching an agreement, do you think?
Look, I think speaking generally about ceasefires, I think the most difficult part about reaching one of these agreements is definitely the power dynamics between the parties. And when I say power dynamics, I think that power can come in sort of different forms, but I think generally, I guess it falls under two main headings, and they would be, for me, I guess, military power and kind of political power. And so if we translate that example to this particular case of Israel and Hamas, I think obviously Israel has has an overwhelming amount of military power in this case, and we've seen that in terms of the complete bombardment of the Strip since October 7. But obviously Hamas has this kind of ace card in terms of the now, I think, around 134 hostages that it still holds that Israel wants back. And that's kind of a, like a political power that it holds over Israel. And one of the real problems is that Hamas doesn't have any more real cards to play. This is obviously a really big card that it holds. So it's not very willing to give up those hostages, basically. So it's using them as leverage to, you know, get as many concessions out of Israel as it can. One of the other power dynamics I think that's really interesting in this case that I guess would come under that political sort of broader heading as well is that there's this growing international sentiment, I think, that we've seen against Israel's actions in the Gaza Strip. And, you know, I'm including the genocide case, obviously, that's before the International Court of Justice at the moment, and just sort of growing international sentiment, I think, in protests that we've seen in governments, you know, increasingly condemning what's happening in Gaza and saying that there needs to be a ceasefire and aid needs to flow more freely into the Strip.
And so do you think the influence of those other countries around the world is actually going to make an impact here on whether or not an agreement is reached, how long the ceasefire could be for, that kind of thing?
Look, I definitely think that's one of the factors at play here. I think it's all those different power dynamics that I mentioned above, and probably more so. You know, for example, I mean, one of the, you know, current sticking points with this, you know, current negotiations that they're underway in Cairo at the moment is Israel has said that it wants a list of names of the hostages. It wants Hamas to be very specific about who it's still holding, but Hamas will not release that until after there's a ceasefire agreement. So we get a sense there in that just to and fro that how important the identity of those hostages are, for example, whether they're men, women or children, because that obviously impacts Israel's calculus in terms of what it will need to give Hamas in exchange for, you know, some of those hostages. And just to give, you know, a more concrete example in that regard, for, you know, in 2011, one Israeli soldier, and that was Gilad Shalit, who had been held by Hamas for 5 years in Gaza, was released in exchange for 1,000 Palestinian prisoners from Israeli jails. So obviously the price, it can be high in terms of the number of Palestinians that could be released for many of the men, you know, that Hamas has taken now that have involvement with the Israeli military and things like that.
Is there pressure to get a ceasefire in place before Ramadan?
I think, again, that probably comes under this more sort of symbolic type of pressure. Obviously, Ramadan's a very religiously holy month for Muslims. And I think, you know, like we've seen in historically, you know, we've seen Christmas truces in the World War One and in World War Two and things like that. So there's, I guess, in terms of these religious holidays, there's a symbolic pressure that I think the parties, well, and I guess the international community would like to see a ceasefire before Ramadan. And hopefully, you know, the suffering, like I said, is incredibly great in Gaza at the moment. So hopefully some of that symbolic pressure under political power and political pressure might come to bear on the situation as well.
You're listening to Hack. I'm Dave Marchese. I'm speaking with Marika Sosnowski from Melbourne Law School, an expert on ceasefires, about the situation in Gaza right now. There are calls for this ceasefire to be 6 weeks. I'm wondering if that's considered a long period for a pause in fighting.
The other pauses in fighting that we've had so far in this current war, I think there was really only the 7-day one that sort of was adhered to. I mean, by my calculation, there's actually been a number of ceasefires. If kind of a ceasefire is, which is sort of the broad definition of a ceasefire, is an agreement to stop fighting for a period of time. There's been actually a number of those kind of agreements as part of the current war. The only one that's actually been implemented is that sort of 7-day, 5-day plus 7 truce or pause, they called it. I don't think 6 weeks is abnormal in the scheme of ceasefires. Parties generally get to decide how long these things go for in practice. But hopefully, the hope is that whatever is agreed to in terms of time frame, that that's adhered to by both parties. I think the agreement, if they come to one, will be quite a like the pause and truce that happened before. I think it will be quite a choreographed affair that we saw, you know, quite a lot of specific terms of the agreement written into it in terms of when hostages would be released, when prisoners would be released from Israeli jails, where they would go, who would transport them, the timing of these things. I think this agreement will hold, and, you know, and definitely to do with how much aid is coming in and where that aid will come from into the Gaza Strip as well. So I think, again, we will see, hopefully, if there is a ceasefire, we'll see a very complicated, complex, choreographed document that has a lot of terms regarding the specifics of that agreement.
Marika, when a ceasefire is playing out, what's happening at that point? Because I guess we all just see maybe no fighting happening, think that it's just a pause in everything, but there must be some serious negotiations still going on about how to maintain the ceasefire or what happens next. Is that right?
It depends on the conflict, I think, Dave. And I think, look, in this conflict, whether we, you know, obviously there's different narratives that go on. You know, some people see this conflict as starting on the 7th of October. Some people obviously see this conflict as starting on in 1948, if not before. So there's obviously a massive amount of political dynamics going on around sort of negotiating a more binding or a more lasting peace agreement, or agreement that at least brings about a kind of formalised closure to the hostilities and provides ideally some security for both Palestinians and Israelis. Hopefully that will all be going on, you know, in the background of a ceasefire, but obviously a ceasefire itself is really just the tip of the iceberg in terms of the political negotiations that have to happen in terms of, you know, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict more broadly.
Well, we appreciate your take on all of that. Thank you very much for joining us. Marika Sosnowski from Melbourne Law School, thank you for coming on Hack.
Thanks, Dave.
And a few messages coming through. Someone says, disgusted by the Labor government's stance on the genocide in Gaza and withdrawal of funding. You know, important to point out, Israel denies that the war in Gaza is a genocide. Another message come through saying it's been a really discouraging response from the Australian government so far. And someone else says 6 weeks is disgusting. We should be calling for a permanent ceasefire.
Hack. History books were kind of written about men, by men. And now, like, platforms like Wikipedia really give us the opportunity to change that.
On Triple J.
Wikipedia. We all rely on it so much. A lot of us probably take this massive resource for granted. Whenever we need a crash course on something, just a little curious, there's an article there breaking it all down. Wikipedia is one of the most popular websites on the internet, and its data is used to inform millions of Google searches. Recently, it's also fueling heaps of AI language models. Like, they use Wikipedia data as their main tool for learning. But moderators of the world's biggest encyclopedia are dropping out fast. There's claims of abuse, sexism, even death threats. So what does all that mean for the future of the internet's biggest information source? Well, Nathan Nicodula's been looking into it.
Well, I was doing species of beetles before, just mainly species using databases. I was about to start making some more articles again today because I love actually making articles.
I'm talking to Alex Thompson. He's an editor on Wikipedia, someone who volunteers his time to make sure the site is accurate and up to date. According to him, he's done at least 100,000 edits, which he says isn't even that much.
There's about 500 pages get made every day. Run a script that fixes typos through that. In order to do that, I have to check each edit manually to make sure it makes sense.
Alex has been editing since he was 15. Nowadays, he says he spends about an hour a day on Wikipedia, which seems like a lot of time, but he says it used to be heaps more.
Years ago, I was studying at college. I was studying a bunch of different subjects, and I didn't get the best grades I could at the subjects I was studying because I was spending so long on Wikipedia.
It's because of editors like Alex that articles on Wikipedia even exist in the first place. But in the past few years, a growing number of editors have been leaving the site because of toxic comments.
I've had all kinds of stuff. I mean, sometimes it'll be, if someone just calls me, like, fat or gay or something on Wikipedia, then, I mean, obviously that's not a very nice thing to say, but, like, if it's something like name-calling like that, I just sort of laugh it off. I don't really care about it. But sometimes, like, a guy messaged me one time saying he knew where I live.
I mean, how did that make you feel, like?
It made me feel nervous at the time, but I wouldn't even be nervous seeing that now, but it's because I was about 16 or 17.
Wikipedia is a core part of the internet, By some measures, it's even bigger than Pornhub and Amazon. But research by the University of Technology Sydney suggests that harassment of its moderators is a big problem. And not just for the mods themselves.
One of the problems that Wikipedia has is that it has this gender problem, so it has much less women editors.
This is Dr. Ivan Smirnov. He says a study he's worked on found 38% of current Wiki volunteers say they've been harassed. And he thinks it's turning some groups of moderators away.
So women encounter more extreme comments, and also they are more affected by them. In this case, Wikipedia can really collapse quite quickly.
Ivan also says that if moderators are being driven away by harassment, then an increasing lack of diversity in editors will have huge impacts on the type of information on the site. He says it's exacerbating what's already a real problem.
Women are less well represented on Wikipedia. There's much less article about them. Often, if it's article about women, it's because she's wife of someone, not because of her own achievements. I'm talking about gender, but that's mostly because it's the most studied topic. We could assume that the same happening with other minorities, it's just less studied topic.
Ivan says it's a problem on its own, but it's also a problem that's already growing far beyond Wikipedia because of AI. Wikipedia is the most used encyclopedia of all time, and data on Wikipedia contributes to millions of Google searches. It's also being used to train most AI language models because it's a free database.
We already know that AI has a strong bias, like gender bias, ethnic bias, that was already observed. And the reason is because data is biased. It's actually like a chain. There was like historical inequalities, then go to books, and then from books it goes to Wikipedia, and from Wikipedia it's now going to this generative AI.
If this problem isn't fixed, Dr. Smirnov and Alex both think this could affect the information on the internet forever.
I'm not sure how they should respond to it, really, because like they've tried to get new editors to join in areas that are related to women, but then they're just not communicating to these new editors properly.
We actually hope that maybe our study would inform these people and maybe they changed their opinion. Maybe they finally implement some moderation.
Hack on Triple J.
Nathan Nigidula reporting there. Got some messages coming through on Hack's Instagram. Alex says, maybe I should give in and make another $4 donation that they've been begging for every month since 2015. Someone else, Josh, says, because AI is absolutely hellish, maybe we should make a bunch of fake wiki articles just to completely mess it up. Hey, some thoughts, opinions there. Going to move on though.
Hack.
You're meant to be only charging what is the cost of acceptance. Some are charging more than that and getting away with it.
On Triple J.
The surcharge. It gets us every time. You go to pay for something at a cafe or a little shop. Maybe you notice a sign warning you about an extra charge to use your card. Or maybe you don't notice it at all.
Hack.
I didn't even know that whole thing.
What's one more micropayment on top of 100 other micropayments?
Surely it doesn't add up to that much, does it?
Why is there a surcharge? Because we live in a day and age where cards are used for everything.
And I think, oh, I should actually just use my card and maybe I won't get a surcharge. But I often just tap all the time because it's so much easier.
Well, what's the hit? Like, I'd like to know what I'm paying for.
On Triple J.
Yeah, a lot of young Australians wondering what the surcharge is all about, really, because we do pay them. The reason I'm talking about it is a story is out today saying Australians are losing nearly $1 billion a year in card surcharges. Why is that? Well, let's ask an expert. Brad Kelly is Managing Director of Payments Consultancy Payment Services, and he's with us now. G'day, Brad. Thanks for coming on Hack.
G'day, happy to be here.
Why do we pay these card surcharges? What's it all about?
Well, we don't actually have much of a choice. That's probably the problem. Look, it's a bit of a long story, but I'll condense it as quickly as I can. Back in the early 2000s, the Reserve Bank removed the no surcharge rule. So until then, you weren't allowed a surcharge, and then they said it's okay. And then by 2017, the ACCC said that merchants can recoup the cost of acceptance. So the assumption was that the cost of acceptance, so that's what the merchant pays the bank, that cost would go down. What's happened is it's gone through the roof. So we have this perfect storm where you've got more debit card and credit card transactions going through the system. You've got more payments happening within that system. You have a more expensive system and the ability to surcharge. And so what's going on is small businesses are the ones who are impacted by this the most, And younger people, 18 to 29, are the heaviest users of cards versus cash, especially debit cards. So it's a perfect storm.
It's interesting, right? Because, you know, young people may not be using credit cards, but they're still paying that surcharge, that top figure, that top rate that they would be paying if they were using a credit card. Why is that? Who's in control of that?
Well, they're subsidising credit card users. So what's happened is very cleverly the banks and payment providers have worked out they can charge a flat rate to a merchant instead of pricing for each transaction type. I won't go into all that, but each kind of transaction costs a different amount of money. So a debit card is really cheap. So a $100 debit transaction costs a bank less than 30 cents to process. But they know that they can charge a merchant on a $100 transaction, $1.50 or $2 for that transaction. That merchant then has to get that money back somehow, either through higher prices or through surcharging. So just so we're clear, it's not small businesses and small merchants surcharging. It's not gouging, sorry. They are surcharging, but they're recouping the cost, which has gone up. So unfortunately, debit cards and credit cards have all been lumped in together and the banks have done a sales job and said, here you go, here's a flat rate, and everyone will be happy. And that's very misleading. And it's, as you said at the beginning, it's about $1 billion worth of surcharges.
So how do you get around it, Brad? Like if you're paying with a card, and I mean, a lot of young people are using Apple Pay or just tapping now, but like if you're using a card, if you insert the card or swipe the card and select savings or check, will that reduce the amount you're paying in surcharge?
Look, that used to work, right? And that was a way of forcing a transaction to FPOS. So just so everyone's clear, FPOS is actually a debit network that's been around for about 45 years. It's not the overall name that we use for cards in this country. It's actually a network of debit transactions. And it's unique in the world because it gives competition to Visa and MasterCard. Visa and MasterCard nearly destroyed it a few years ago, but it's actually had a resurgence. But when you tap your card, it forces the transaction in most cases, 99% of cases, to Visa and MasterCard, which is probably two or three times more expensive to process. The problem we have now is the surcharging is built in, is baked into the system now so that you're going to get surcharged no matter what you do. So the old trick of putting your card in, getting check, savings or credit, choosing check or savings, no one has checks anymore, choosing either those two options, that would force it to FPOS. That's pretty much gone. So we are stuck. And unfortunately, the only alternative in many cases is cash. And I don't like to say that, but it's where we are.
Well, I was going to ask, like cash is obviously a way around this, but we know usage, especially among younger Australians, is really down at the moment. Like it does appear like cash is no longer king, right?
No, look, I mean, there's some great stats out on there. I mean, in 2007, 18 to 29-year-olds used cash for 67% of payments. In 2022, 6%. So the overall market's at 13. So you can see that this surcharging thing with debit cards is disproportionately impacting younger people and older people because the over 65s have adopted debit cards as well. They're up 300%. And in the middle are credit card users who are reaping the benefits because they're actually the ones being subsidised. And credit cards have become a bit of an old person's product. If you look at the spend, it's up. If you look at all the numbers, they're heading north. But everyone else is walking away from credit cards and going to debit cards. And I think it's important we point this out. Afterpay and Zip did a very good job trying to tell everyone that we moved to them. We did not. They're only about half of 1% of the entire payments market. So it's debit cards, which are the dominant form factor in Australia.
Interesting stuff. It's definitely worth explaining and it can be a bit complicated, but thank you for breaking that all down for us. Payment expert Brad Kelly, thank you very much for joining us on Hack.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Hack on Triple J.
And that's all we've got time for on the Hack podcast for now. I'll catch you next time.